Hello and welcome to this latest in our series of podcasts on issues concerning customs. I am Anthony Buckley. I'm the chair of Customs Knowledge Institute, and it is my pleasure to host this series of podcasts. Today we're talking about sustainability. A very popular topic at the moment worldwide, under a number of different headings. And for this discussion, we're privileged to be joined by Ira Rees, who is the Technical Director of Global Security Innovation Strategies, or GSIS, and also by Monica Bielskienė, who is a Senior Manager in PricewaterhouseCoopers in Lithuania. To begin with, this topic of sustainability—it's a word that's applied to just about everything nowadays. Everything has to be sustainable. What does it mean in customs? Well, the EU has listed a number of topics that it believes should fall within this umbrella of sustainability in relation to trade, and it includes environmental issues. Social issues, human rights issues, employee issues, including forced labor and so on, and also anti-corruption and anti-bribery initiatives. So it's a very wide canvas. It's not immediately obvious that sustainability in that definition matches exactly with the, shall we say, the climate change definition of sustainability in terms of the survival of the planet. And one of the things I'd like to get a general comment on at the beginning is, to what degree is this sustainability agenda, leaving aside its moral desirability to change all these things, it may be morally justified for Europe to dictate to other countries about their policies under the headings I've mentioned. But in implementing it through trade sanctions and trade monitoring, is there a danger that, if you like, trade discrimination is actually creeping in to the agenda? And as it were, is trade discrimination perhaps being given a respectable veneer by attaching the label of sustainability? What do you think, Ira?
As it ramps up across the world, I think right now it's basically in Western Europe and maybe North America, where the emphasis is quite heavy. It's going to have to be done just to basically even out trade. I mean, fair trade is fair trade. Some people follow the rules, some people don't follow the rules. So if you want to have a fair trading system, there needs to be a way to even it out. My concern with it is that importers and exporters will look at any kind of extra duties applied for sustainability purposes. It's probably just going to be looked at as another expense that has to be dealt with, nothing more, nothing
Sure.
less. It won't be looked at as a, well, we're saving the earth, but another tariff duty. I believe that's probably going to be what's looked at least at the beginning.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that's a very balanced view of it. Monica, would you agree with that?
I am a true believer of that moral purpose. I do believe it. So in my heart, I am happy that maybe the measures chosen are not the best ones, but I think we just cannot afford ourselves not to do anything. So maybe we'll do some mistakes, maybe we'll do some adjustments, but we'll move a step forward to achieving the goals. On the other hand, really, I do see those everyday life situations where importers face with this huge amount of new requirements, and the amount is so huge that you cannot do it like in a quality way. So it might become just ticking off boxes. So really, it's as Ira said, looking for a balance.
I suppose, I suppose for myself, I would have been, it's probably my generation, but I'm very much a proponent of free trade and open trade. And I see these regulations, however worthy they may be, I see these regulations as having the effect long term of suppressing world trade. And I don't think that can be a good thing. But then there is a balance always between these things. I mean, I share your commitment to saving the planet, Monica. I just wonder about the mechanism, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yes. It'll be a while before we determine what the right, correct way of putting a tax on sustainability. Mm. It'll come, but it is going to be, as said by Monica, it's going to be a couple of false starts, and maybe we'll get it right in about 10 years or 20 years.
Yeah, that seems very sensible. Could we move on to some specifics that are of interest at the moment? I know this is an ongoing agenda and further regulations are to come, but one that you wrote a very interesting article about, Ira, is the prohibition on the use of forced labour and the requirement on importers to certify in particular that goods have no portion of their origin in the Uyghur region of China. You make the point that the regulation is almost, it concentrates on the outcomes. You must prove the negative, I think is a phrase you've used. Would you like to expand on that a little bit?
Yes, it's fairly new. I mean, since we're all customs and trade people, we understand the term substantial transformation, double substantial transformation. But the way that the forced labor statutes are being written, it's something new that we haven't run across before, is you have to prove that your product does not come from someplace, which is in a theoretical way, yes, it's doable by doing basically processing the flow of the product from raw materials into the final product. But it becomes very complicated when one has to basically prove that it doesn't come from the Uyghur region when it goes through multiple different steps in China before it basically makes it out of the country. So it doesn't come from that. It seems to me the first time a government is telling a trader, well, you have to prove it doesn't come from there.
Yes, and we have a somewhat comparable issue in Europe with the imposition of sanctions against Russia and Belarus, where, again, it's on the exporter and the importer to prove that at no point in the supply chain is there a contribution from the sanctioned countries? And again, you're attempting to prove the negative. I mean, in terms of enforcement, if in practical terms, say from the point of view of a trader, if the trader makes what objectively could be seen as reasonable efforts to prove the negative, as you say, and shows that evidence, what do you think would be the enforcement attitude of the authorities? Like, would the authorities feel obliged to prove the opposite, to prove that there was an input from the sanctioned region?
Well, I'm familiar with way the United States enforces it, and if you can show Customs and Border Protection a supply chain that definitively proves that it doesn't come from the Uyghur region, then basically you're okay. But basically, to even get on the, get on CBP's radar, you have to basically show that somebody would have to come in, make an allegation that you are importing from something. And basically, you'd have you'd have to show supply chain. If it's reasonable, yes, you're okay, and the allegation goes away.
So yeah, that's really interesting, and of course very sensible, and it's the same on this side of the Atlantic, that for customs to become interested, there must be a flag raised in some fashion. We have the various risk conditions programmed into the computer scans that are run regularly on declarations, and it's possible that a particular item or product might be brought to the attention of the authorities, and that would be input as a risk indicator. And that could give rise to a customs intervention. But as you say, if I suppose what I'm really suggesting is that there is the possibility of a customs official or a customs authority deciding to take a hard line, as it were, and insisting that reasonable care is not a sufficient safeguard or a sufficient defense. That is the fear, I know, in Europe regarding sanctions, that because it's a regulation that requires a certain outcome rather than a regulation that specifies certain behaviors by the trader, specifying the outcome leaves it open to interpretation. And I think that's the risk that many people see.
I've always felt, and I've consulted with several law firms on this, big law firms in the United States, and it's too expensive and it's too easy to make this allegation go away. But frankly, if the way CBP is enforcing it was brought in front of the Court of International Trade, I'm fairly well convinced that the court would say this is unconstitutional. It's not going to flow.
Yeah.
You know. So I've told CBP this, and I'm still well regarded, but not as well regarded when I used to work there. But but I said, you know, you guys.
I can identify with that because I retired from customs as well.
Yeah. We're on the dark side, you know that.
Exactly.
So I don't believe it will survive a court challenge if it's done, but it's too easy to make these allegations go away to go through a court.
Yeah, I think that's correct. That would certainly be the case in common law jurisdictions. Or in civil law jurisdictions, it can be a little different. Just yesterday, we were discussing a situation where the European Court of Justice gave a decision on a penalty, which included the phrase that the penalty was justified regardless of the good faith of the trader. Which in a common law jurisdiction, that wouldn't fly. But as I say, different jurisdictions, different rules.
That is nasty, yes.
That is nasty, yeah. yes, we feel great sympathy for our colleagues in Lithuania.
yeah, but Tony, if you would allow just on that reasonable actions, yeah. I think in the EU, it's a very strange tradition in the difference between VAT and mm-hmm. customs regime, because in VAT reasonable actions are absolutely enough. It's always the court always just analyzes what actions did you take and what could you do, and it's always if you did everything what you could, then even if you were involved into VAT fraud or something, even the taxes were not paid, you are released. And that's in right. customs, it's like 180% different. It's like somebody stole something from you. You are guilty. Somebody did not tick the box. You are guilty. And as you illustrated very well with your last example, regardless of your good faith, like you are responsible. So it's a very like impressive distinction. Though I do not see such a distinction like VAT and customs. They are both taxes. They are both important. Why is that different? I have a clue why.
Well, so do I.
But yeah, it's for me, as Ira said, it does not seem constitutional, but it's just how the tradition goes on, and it doesn't seem to change the direction.
Absolutely, yes, it is. And even within customs law, again, perhaps arising from its tradition, there are many, many areas that are grey, where it's not clear exactly what your obligations are. But that's so sustainability, and these new regulations simply takes it a little step further. But to bring it to Europe then, in particular, the CBAM regulation, Monica, you, I know, have studied this. And I mean, could we get some kind of overview thoughts from you on how it's operating or how it's likely to operate?
Yeah, so it's already on. So starting from October 1st, all the goods that are imported, the importer will have to declare how much emission, CO2 emissions, carbon emissions were released when producing those goods. So that's the essence of this CBAM. So now it's only declaration, only providing data to the special EU hub. And then starting from 2026, it will be also a fiscal effect. So importers will have to buy those CBAM certificates according to the emissions. Yeah. So that's pretty much how it works. But I want to just maybe go to the issues rather than description of that. So I think at least in Lithuania, the first and the very huge issue is level of awareness. So it's really very low. So yes. I still meet the clients who just would ask, oh, sorry, what are the letters you are saying? It's CBA, yes. What? Yeah. So it's really very new. And as you now, your goods, even if it's CBAM goods, they still go through the customs with no stopping them, with no any additional information that they are subject to some additional regulations. So you just continue your activities. And I think after that term, when the first declaration will have to be submitted, and that's the end of the January, when that CBAM register will reconcile all the data, and those importers will get a notification that you missed the deadline to submit your CBAM declaration, that's when the level of awareness will rise. So,
That sounds rather painful. There's one issue just in reading about CBAM that I wasn't entirely clear on, and perhaps you can clarify it for me. Is it envisaged into the future, when the scheme is fully operational, that importers will need a specific authorization to import the nominated goods?
Yeah, they will. And it's you will be able to start to try to register starting from 2025. And starting 2026, you will not be able to import those CBAM goods without that authorized status. It will be authorized CBAM operator. The registration will not be that easy as getting an EORI number. So it's more difficult, but still it's not that complicated as getting in-work processing license or something. It's easier. So, but that is something that the importers will have to undergo in order to keep importing those goods.
The picture that comes into my mind, Monica, is that in Ireland, as you know, we have a very close traditional association with the United Kingdom, particularly in the construction sector. So you would have a situation where, for example, a UK-based company might undertake a construction project in Ireland. And that happens all the time. But what you're saying is they can't just telephone headquarters back in the UK and say, send over a load of steel. That won't be possible. They'll need an authorization in the EU in order to do that.
Yeah, they will have that. Can be done through the indirect representation.
Yes,
well, it's not necessary, but still, as you say, you will have to find someone to have that authorization.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and as you see it, I mean, taking all of this together, maybe to go back to the overview of the whole thing, is it, do you, either of you, envisage that these regulations will evolve in order to become more sustainable, with a small s, if I can put it like that, to become more practical? Because as they are enunciated now, they seem to have potentially enormous ramifications for the conduct of trade. Do you think that simplifications will be found?
I am also optimistic, but maybe also because I have heard about that deforestation and forced labor, which seems much more complicated to me. With the CBAM, I think that the first years will be really difficult finding ways to your suppliers to get the information because it's so difficult. I have seen the templates made by European Commissions, like Excel files with 10 sheets full of numbers. So yeah, it's impressive. But on the other hand, when you do that for the first time, when you just understand what's in there, and you are all set up, maybe you just need some minor changes during the process. Maybe. And another thing is that CBAM is well, actually, like expansion of the EU emission trading system, which is already operating for like 20 years in Europe. So it's built on something. Somebody knows how to do those calculations. So I guess that that practice will help to deal with CBAM as well. And maybe it will be hard. And it will be hard at the beginning, but once set up, I believe it's not like with the forced labor or deep origin. It's calculatable. You just need to find the ways to do that.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Monica. What do you think? Will deforestation and forced labor and deep origin, will simplifications be found to assist practical traders?
Well, I think deforestation is a lot easier than, slave labor, because basically with deforestation, if you're certain, you can basically almost tell where the piece of wood comes from, even after you've manufactured it many times. There are very sophisticated isotope counting methods that you can say which part of the earth this comes from. So if which survive. I mean, it's the same, I guess, theory as if you have a cotton shirt coming in and you say it's not cotton from the Uyghur region, you can basically do an isotope counting on it, tell where isotope ratio. The problem, and I think where it's going to fall apart, is, and as you, Anthony, if you read my article, Enrica has, anything synthetic, which is always was my strong point, it basically has a very, very complicated supply chain where you need very many different types of documents to sustain it. The United States has gotten away from that, as I believe Canada is, that, well, if you give me a reasonable supply chain, it'll show where it comes from. But the problem is that, and if you've done any investigations in China, even if they're cooperative, which they usually are not, you have ton reams of paper in Chinese that, very difficult to translate. So you have to collect, and I, basically, and I gave the example of a basically a beach ball made of polyvinyl chloride. Well, I mean, you have all kinds of pipelines running through Uyghur that basically can flow through from Russia or from Turkey that may or may not stop in. You have different types of products coming out of the earth in Uyghur, which basically are turned into a ethylene, which basically is transshipped someplace else, which is turned into vinyl chloride, which is shipped someplace else and stored someplace else and released on a pipeline at a certain time, that basically is sent to a manufacturer to polymerize it, who sells his pellets all over China. So, I mean, just think of how many documents you need to say, no, you're lying, your supply chain is lying. So basically, I can tell them, CBP, basically anything on my supply chain, and dare them to basically investigate it. They'll never be able to do it.
I know, I know. Actually, it seems to me, listening to you both, that the sustainability agenda, covering everything from environment to human rights and so on, it divides into two, really, doesn't it? One is, as Monica has said, issues like CBAM, which are clearly of benefit to the environment and are essentially restricting excessive carbon emissions. And that's a direct link with environmental concerns. On the other hand, then you have things like the Uyghur prohibition, where it's essentially cultural. It's saying we don't approve of the way in which you run your country, and therefore we're going to discriminate against your goods. And in that latter one, you'd wonder, because ultimately cultural differences are properly the subject of diplomacy. And you'd wonder whether the tool of trade restriction is appropriate for that kind of purpose. Like, as I say, deforestation, carbon emissions, measurable, quantifiable, all good. We don't approve of you. How do you quantify that? And how do you know when to apply the sanctions and when to stop them? Is it a question of, Donald Trump being re-elected president and having a dinner with Xi Jinping and suddenly all this goes away? I just wonder about the appropriateness of trade sanctions for cultural reasons. Would either of you have a comment on that, or will you leave me in my delusional state?
It's telling somebody else how they should act, which I mean, you're asking for an opinion. I mean, so we don't want slave labor materials into the United States. Fine. But who's to say it's any, some Europeans might say, well, we believe in trade unions and this is a non-union article. So I believe, it should be levied. I mean, it's just a matter of values. What value do you put on it? There's slave labor going on in China. But who's to say that, frankly, exploitation of young children in Africa for out in the farms is any
different,
worse? Yeah. I mean, so it's just a matter of, a little bit too, too loose to your morals, where you can basically use it as a restraint of trade, which, I'm wondering when some of these things end up in front of the World Trade Organization to sort things out. I mean, to me, it's very loose. It's just a value thing, a slave labor, child labor, union labor. I mean, you're determining how others should run their countries.
Yeah. Kind of cultural imperialism.
Yeah. Of course, yes.
Yeah. What do you think, Monica? Are we being far too?
Yeah, it's hard to me to deal with that in my mind that slavery, forced labor is a cultural thing. For me, it's like a red line, seems like a red line. But I do understand where it comes from. We are totally different countries with totally different values. And for them, it's not really that obvious that it's a red line. So I do agree that it's from the perspective of the Western world that it's bad. But I am raised in the Western world, so it seems like bad for me. So
I know, but within the lifetime of myself and Ira, we saw situations of indentured service, for example, where the servant was obliged by law to work for the employer and could not leave and could not vary their conditions. Is that slavery? Is that a red line? There are different, and even within Europe at the moment, there are instances of people who, through economic necessity, are obliged to do certain things that you would regard as being very undesirable. So, it's a matter of slavery. Yes, I agree. The word slavery, I think everybody regards that as a red line. But then define the word. What is slavery? What are the conditions? You know, it becomes blurred, I think. But yes, I know. Yeah, the Western values do apply.
Yeah, but yeah, I think having as like what I hear from Ira, having a special focus only on China, one region, it's already also signaling something.
Yeah, it is indeed. I think just to we're coming to the end of our time now, I think. And I mean, for myself, I'd just to sum up very briefly, and then maybe, you know, if you have any closing remarks, that'd be very welcome. For me, I see this as part of the death of globalization, that where from the end of the Second World War up to very recently, the focus of the Western world certainly was on free trade and openness of trade around the world. There's a very marked shift now towards more protectionism, more control, more security of supply domestically. And I think into the future, no matter how meritorious and justifiable the sustainability agenda is, using trade restriction as a means of advancing it will inevitably have a depressing effect on world trade and contribute to this overall protectionist era, I think, that we're facing into. So that's my takeaway. Would either of you like to make any closing comment, Ira, perhaps?
Well, Anthony, I'm really with you. Before World War II, the world was basically, broken up into different trading blocks. Since World War II, trading has opened up. And it basically has brought a lot of benefits to a lot of parts of the areas of the world that might not have been as not as wealthy, but as been in a lot more poverty than it would be if it weren't for this trade. For instance, India, China was a backward country. And trade has made these countries, brought them into the modern era, made a lot of people live better lives. And basically, going back to before World War II into different enclaves is going to make not only the world poorer, but as we're seeing it now, and particularly both in Europe and the United States, you're going to see massive migrations from one area where, basically poverty is endemic to areas where, people can take care of themselves. So we better get this right, and we don't have many more years to do it. So hopefully somebody will come to their senses and figure it out. Maybe we can work together. But that's a little bit quixotic, I think. But I'm hoping for best for my grandchildren anyway.
Indeed, indeed. I don't think there's anything wrong with being a little quixotic from time to time. Monica, what do you think?
I have two very different points to make. First, we are discussing often with Enrica, and she will not forgive me if I miss this thing, but we are really forgetting about the small business and
Yes.
how they will deal with those things. Maybe the big companies can do all those analysis and risk assessments, and the small company with two employees reading all the regulations, it seems like a crazy, crazy task. And another very different point about that free trade, and I am currently like under such a not mindset, but maybe an opinion that growth itself should not be like self-aim, that we want to grow all the time, no matter the cost. So we must see the cost to the planet. So as I began with, so I do think that those measures are necessary, but it's just have to be calibrated because we do see it is used. The purpose is good, but sometimes it's used for the wrong purpose.
They're very, very deep and thought-provoking points indeed, Monica. Thank you very much. I think your point about the small trader is very well made. I think the small trader will become rare indeed in this new world of ours. So at that, perhaps we will close this session for today. And thank you, Ira. Thank you, Monica. And thank you to all our listeners who
Thank you,
tune in.
Tommy.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
you all.
Pleasure.
Okay.